Gospel of Mark. We began last week working our way through this fantastic book. We didn't get a long way into it last week, so if you missed and are brand new, good news, you're not too far behind. And in fact, I think probably in about 2 or 3 minutes, I can try to bring you up to speed of where we were last week and the things we were considering so that this week, hopefully, as we work through a number of verses, all the pieces will start to come together for us. We began last week just with a simple observation that Mark comes to bring us the gospel, much like that video speaks to us about. The gospel was just the good news that something has happened in human history, and that thing brings us joy and it changes our lives. That's the gospel. The good news is that Jesus has come, the Son of God. And in the first 13 verses of Mark, Mark gives us I view it as a gift. He gives us a prologue, and before you sort of get overwhelmed at the thought of technical English-sounding terms, let me just put it this way. The prologue is simply Mark's gift to us, the readers, to help us understand some things that the original people watching Jesus, hearing him for the first time, weren't privileged to know and to understand yet. We're told right up front that Jesus is the Son of God. We're told by Mark right up front that he comes in fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy and that he is none other than God himself come in flesh to deliver us from sin. That's what Mark allows us to see, that those who first met Jesus would take a few years to discover for themselves. Mark goes on in those first few verses and introduces us to a man named John who comes from the wilderness, which is Mark's clue to us that John comes doing the business of God. In fact, he comes doing the business of God that will actually transform human history. And it's reminiscent, it reminds us of God's great work one time, many, many centuries before this, when God came to his people who were slaves in Egypt and said, I am going to deliver you. And the way of delivery is to take you into the wilderness where I will draw you near to myself and I will speak to you and care for you and encourage you. That's what Mark's pointing us to. John comes from the wilderness, comes announcing another who will follow him, who is mightier than he. And that's where we ended up last week, at the verge of being introduced to the one whom John has come to prepare the way for. And we want to pick up this morning in verse 9. I'll read a few verses and we'll consider them together. In those days, verse 9 of chapter 1, Jesus came from Nazareth in Galilee and was baptized by John in the Jordan. And when he came up out of the water, immediately he saw the heavens opening and the Spirit descending on him like a dove. And a voice came from heaven, "You are my beloved Son. With you I am well pleased." The Spirit immediately drove him out into the wilderness, and he was in the wilderness 40 days, being tempted by Satan. And he was with the wild animals, and the angels were ministering to him. Now that's the end of the prologue of Mark, and we're actually going to try to get a little bit beyond that this morning. But let me just mention a few things before we move on in Mark's account of the life of Jesus Christ. Mark introduces us to Jesus in a rather peculiar way, because in verse 9 he chooses some fairly significant ways to describe Jesus. He says he comes from Nazareth of Galilee. Now to us, if you're familiar with the story of Jesus, that's just where he's always come from. We have heard right from day one, that was his hometown, he grew up there, that's where he's from. We don't see a lot wrong with that picture, but if you were in Mark's day hearing that for the first time, or in Jesus' day, and someone came from Nazareth and someone came from Galilee, that was your clue that was probably someone who was not good for a lot. Nazareth was known as a nothing place. In fact, later in Jesus' life, he would be referred to by his enemies as Jesus, the one from Nazareth. And what they meant by that was something like this: Jesus, the nobody from nowhere. He couldn't count if he came from Nazareth. And yet, we know he counts. He goes on and says he came from Nazareth of Galilee. Galilee was another place that to the people of Israel was considered a marginal place at best. It was the area of the country that after the Assyrians had invaded and destroyed the nation of Israel about 500 years earlier, it was settled by Gentiles. The Jewish people didn't largely go and live in Galilee. The only Jews who would go and live in Galilee were outcasts or people who were really not that devout or interested in pursuing their faith. And so if you were a Jewish person from Galilee, that was a code for saying you probably weren't that interested in God. The true Jews who were devout and interested in God would not live there. And so Mark says, we need to meet the one that John has announced. His name is Jesus, and he comes from a place that no one could have expected, Nazareth of Galilee, an outcast. Not only that, but the next phrase we meet there is probably one that leaves us scratching our heads, because we're told that Jesus comes from Nazareth of Galilee, a no one from nowhere, and the first thing he does when he encounters John is he gets baptized. Now, if you remember back to last week, we saw that John's baptism was to prepare a sinful people to meet a holy God. It was to make things ready for God to encounter humanity. What then is Jesus doing being baptized? For the last couple thousand years, people have come up with various theories, tried to explain why Jesus, a sinless man, the Son of God, would come and go through that process. We actually just sang of his sinlessness this morning. He became sin who knew no sin, that we might become his righteousness. Why would Jesus do it? In fact, John himself points out the problem in Matthew chapter 3. In Matthew's version of the same account, John comes to Jesus and says, "I shouldn't be baptizing you. You should be baptizing me." But Jesus answers this way, and here's all the answer we need to explain the mystery. "I will do this to fulfill all righteousness. If God has issued a command to humanity, I will perfectly follow every last one." He doesn't say it, but clearly the implication is this: so that day when I go to the cross, there will be nothing, nothing, nothing that I will need to do to make things right between me and God, because I will have lived a perfect, sinless life, and instead I can take upon myself the sin of humanity. Jesus is baptized that day. Now that moment triggers something spectacular in verse 10. The moment he came up out of the water, immediately, Mark tells us, he saw the heavens open and the Spirit descend upon him like a dove. Now a couple things are going on in that simple little phrase. The first thing is actually that literally the heavens are torn open. Now that verse or that term might be familiar to some who are familiar with the story around Easter, when Jesus dies on a cross and the curtain of the temple is torn apart. But the place Mark, I think, has in mind is not that moment. It's actually a moment in the book of Isaiah in chapter 64 when people are crying out, and the prophet Isaiah is calling out to God and saying, "God, oh, that you would tear heaven open and come down." Now, what Mark's helping us understand, once again, similar to what he did back in chapter 1, verse 2 and 3, is that this is the moment when God is, in fact, entering human history. The heavens have been torn apart. God comes down. Second thing he tells us is that the Spirit descended on him like a dove. Now, again, that's just not just a throwaway sort of comment or description. That's a very carefully thought through phrase that Mark's using to remind us of something. Back in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2, we're told that as God created, the Spirit of God was there. He was part of the Trinity involved in that whole process. And the description in Genesis 1, 2 in the original Hebrew is actually that the Spirit fluttered during that whole time. So he's fluttering. But when they translated that phrase into Aramaic, they struggled to capture the essence of what that was saying. And so let me read for you the exact Aramaic translation of that phrase that people in Mark's day had read. Here's it. "The earth was without form and empty, and darkness was on the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God fluttered above the face of the waters like a dove. And God spoke." That's Genesis 1, 2 in the Aramaic translation that Jesus and his peers grew up reading. "The earth was without form, empty, darkness was on the face of the earth, and the Spirit of God fluttered above the face of the waters like a dove, and God spoke." Consider then what Mark is saying in verse 10 and 11. The Spirit descended like a dove. What's supposed to happen next? Genesis 1, 2 tells us God speaks. And so, verse 11, "A voice came from heaven. You are my Son, and with you I am well pleased." What Mark's showing us, the picture he's painting here in chapter 1 without ever using the actual words, is that what happened in creation in the moment when God first began everything is being restored right here. In fact, there's one other scene that comes right on the heels of that in verse 12. Because what happens in the Garden of Eden? God creates, the Spirit is there, God speaks, man enters the creation, he's there in the garden, Satan comes and tempts man, and what happens? Man falls into sin, Consider what Mark says next in the story, verse 12. The Spirit immediately drove him, Jesus, into the wilderness. He was in the wilderness 40 days, tempted by Satan. He was with the wild animals, and the angels ministered to him. We know from how Matthew describes the same scene that in the face of temptation, Jesus resists. I think Mark is intentionally wanting us to see something. That in creation, when God worked and man was tempted and fell in the garden, Jesus is now undoing what was first done. What was first broken is being restored. Jesus is now in the wilderness being tempted by Satan, but doesn't fall into sin. Mark wants you to see that. He needs you to see that. So as we read the story that's to follow in verse 14 through the rest of the book, we begin to understand that Jesus is no mere man. He is the Son of God, who has come to restore everything that was broken. You see, you and I both know things are broken. They are. And it's not just a matter of they're broken out there or they're broken in our families or those we know. We know when we're honest with ourselves, they are broken right here. And we need someone who can put the pieces together. Someone who can deal with the problem of sin. And Mark wants you to know you are meeting him in the person of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Now that is the prologue. Those first 13 verses are the things that we get to see and know that the original people standing there couldn't have known. They weren't in the wilderness for 40 days. They didn't have Mark connecting the dots for them. All they got to know is what happens next. And so we want to get to work this morning in verse 14. And if all goes well, we'll make it to about verse 28 before we'll run out of time here this morning. Now, the first thing you need to know, and actually I was talking to someone at coffee time about this, is between verse 13 and verse 14, there is a gap. In fact, if you go read the Gospel of John, chapters 1, 2, and 3 all happen between verse 13 and 14. In fact, it's an entire year of the life of Jesus that Mark just says, you know what, for the sake of the story, I need you to understand the details I need to communicate. I'm just going to leave out that whole part of the story. It's not that it's unimportant, but Mark just says, I'm making a point. I'm trying to teach something that doesn't depend on you knowing those details. So in verse 14, we've missed a significant portion of the story of Jesus Christ in order for Mark to get us to the point where Jesus is walking along the shores of the Sea of Galilee and proclaiming the gospel, the news that God has done something that brings us joy and changes our lives, saying this, the time's fulfilled. That's code for everything that the prophets pointed to. All your expectations, all of our hopes that God was going to enter into human history and redeem and restore. This is the moment. The kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe the gospel. It's saying God's here. God is at work. Ready your hearts for what God's about to do. Now, unfortunately, just because of the way time's going to work and the fact that you don't want to be at church for the next 3 hours, we're going to be dividing up a little bit the story that I think Mark really intended for us to see as a complete unit. The reason I think I want to suggest that is because he's going to use the word immediately to help us keep connecting dots. So as you read through the book of Mark, you're going to see this word often come up, and he says, immediately this, and then immediately Jesus does this, and immediately he goes there. The point Mark makes as he uses that word is to encourage you not to stop reading, because the one story follows on the heels of another in order to communicate a bigger truth. It's like that old saying, you know, don't lose sight of the forest for the trees. He wants us to see the forest. It's the reason why I'm not going to preach a story about, you know, two verses from chapter one about, you know, fishing for men and you know, three verses a little bit later on. Instead, we want to get the big picture because that's what Mark intends for us to see. And unfortunately, as I said, we're only going to see about half of the big picture story from chapter one and two this morning. Next week, we'll pick it up and try to connect the dots. But the big issue for us here this morning that these two chapters are all focused on is what authority does Jesus have to forgive sins? You see it in chapter 2 as he forgives the sins of a paralyzed man and then heals him. The question that people are struggling with there in that scene is coming to us in verse 7 when the scribes and the Pharisees are wondering in their heart, why does he speak like this and where does he get the authority to do it? Now, before we ever get there, Mark's going to help us answer the question. He wants us to know with crystal clarity the authority that Jesus Christ has, and he's going to show us in a few scenes of what that authority looks like. I think probably it's in large part anchored in chapter 1, verse 11, for those of you who are curious about these kind of things. In Mark chapter 11, Pharisees come to Jesus with a question after his triumphal entry. They ask him, "What authority do you have to do and say the things you're saying?" I don't know if you remember the scene, but he answers them with a question. He says, "I will tell you if you answer me one question." And they say, "Okay." He says, "Here's the question. John's baptism, was it from man or was it from God?" Now you can understand the Pharisees have a bit of a dilemma on their hand. They know very clearly that if they say it was from God, then the question is, well, then why didn't you go along with it? And if they answer, well, it was from man, they've got a problem because hundreds of thousands of the people of Israel had gone along with it. They're between a rock and a hard place. They say, "We can't answer the question." And Jesus says, "Well, then I'm not going to answer your question." But I think he did. I think without them realizing, he pointed them to the moment where that question is answered, way back in Mark chapter 1, verse 11, where John was baptizing, where the Spirit of God descends like a dove, and where God says, "This is my Son. I'm well pleased with him." That's where his authority comes from his Father in heaven. But through this next little series of stories, we're going to see his authority displayed in a number of ways. Let's pick up in verse 16 of chapter 1. With our next little scene, passing alongside the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, the brother of Simon, casting a net into the sea, for they were fishermen. And Jesus said to them, "Follow me, and I will make you become fishers of men." And immediately they left their nets and followed him. Going a little further, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who were in their boat mending nets. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and followed him. These men had been successful businessmen. Don't ever take the image that, you know, the fishermen in the Gospels are sort of these poor, you know, just scraping by kind of, you know, lower class people. That is not the case at all. It's probably one of those misunderstandings of what's going on here. These were actually fairly upper class business people in this day and in this culture. In order to become a fisherman, you had to be licensed by the empire, by Rome itself. You had to have a significant amount of money to buy what was essentially a franchise to fish. Then 40% of all your catch would go back to the nation of Rome. That's just the agreement. People who fished, who had this sort of livelihood, tended to be very affluent, very upper crust. In fact, John himself, one of the disciples, we know is on familiar terms with the high priests and is involved somehow with business going on in Jerusalem. We see that later in the gospel story. These were men with a lot to lose. And when Jesus came along and said, "Leave it all behind," he was asking them to give up what we would have considered probably in our day the equivalent to, I used the example in the first service, I'm not sure it's perfect, equivalent to owning a Tim Hortons franchise. Same kind of idea. Takes a lot of money to get the franchise, but then it's lucrative because we all can't stop drinking coffee. That's what's going on in the scene. These men he's calling to follow him are not just able just to say, "Well, you know, all I've got in life is this fishing rod, and so it's not going to cost me anything." It costs them tremendously to respond to the call of Jesus. That is odd. People don't usually do that. There's a couple more odd things going on in that little scene. They also were told, "Leave their father." Now again, we're used to that in our day and age. That's part of how things work. You grow up, you raise your kids, you understand that at some point they're going to leave mom and dad, go off and make a life of their own, you know, pursue their own thing. Very different 2,000 years ago. 2,000 years ago, you raised your kids never left home, they just built an addition onto your house, and they did what you did, and their kids would do what they did, and so on and so forth. Kids never left home. In fact, it would have been considered to be a great dishonor to a parent to do what Jesus is asking these men to do, to leave their family, to follow him. The third peculiar thing about that scene is that it had never been done before. In fact, I mean, you can just imagine even today, if you were to walk out to Swan Lake today and walk along the ice, there'll be some guys out there fishing, and you just cry out in a loud voice, "You go try this, follow me." The only people who might follow are those who misunderstand, thinking you know where there's a good spot to fish. But I can guarantee if you issued that invitation in the sense that Jesus is issuing his invitation, like follow me for the rest of your lives, and I'm going to just redefine your life for you, your occupation, your relationships. I'm going to change everything. People aren't really generally interested in doing that. It's an odd scene. Follow me. I'm going to change everything. You want to know what's even more remarkable about it? It's they do it. That to me is unbelievably staggering. In fact, if you don't yet believe in Jesus and you're here just checking things out and wrestling through questions and trying to figure out who God is and what it is that we believe when we teach this word that we keep opening Sunday after Sunday, I would implore you to consider that evidence. What kind of a man must Jesus have been that when he issued that kind of invitation, people just followed? Think of that for a minute. Which one of us could command that kind of authority? Which one of us could say to someone, follow me and I'm going to change your life and have people consistently respond and respond to the degree that they would willingly give up their lives to continue to do it? Not a one of us. But Jesus did it and people followed. I think it's one of the compelling reasons to consider following Jesus even to this day. But there's one other big challenge here that is there for us who are followers. For those of us who have said, you know, on such and such a date, I made a commitment to Jesus Christ that I would believe in him and trust in him and follow him and love him and obey him. And in my Bible, it's in verse 17. It's right in bright red letters, so I don't miss it. And Jesus says to me, follow me, Don Reeve, and I will make you a fisher of men. See, I happen to believe that that statement is as true for me as it was for John and Peter and Simon and Andrew. That the invitation and the command was not just true 2,000 years ago, but it still remains true to this day. And then here's my problem. I know Jesus is infinitely powerful. I have absolute faith in that. And if there's ever a problem in my life or in this world, it doesn't stem from the fact that Jesus lacks power. And I know Jesus is infinitely trustworthy, that when he makes a promise, you can take it to the bank. And then I read the statement. In fact, I remembered as a little boy, we used to sing this in a song form. Maybe some of you remember that. I will make you fishers of men, fishers of men, fishers of men. I will make you fishers of men if you follow me. It's a condition. And I look at myself in the mirror. I think in my own heart, Jesus has the ability to do it. He's made the promise that that's what he's committing to do. Where then lies the problem if this man is not seeing people come to hear the gospel and respond to Jesus? You know my only conclusion? The only option I have left as I look at that statement is this. You, Don Reeve, are not following Jesus in the way he asked you to follow. I prayed at the start that when we hit the heavy parts, it wouldn't just be one of those things where we'd walk away going, man, Simon, I'm in that camp too. I've never shared the gospel. I've never seen someone come to know Jesus Christ. Wow, that's just really discouraging. I must not be really a follower of Jesus. Here's what I implore you to do. Not just walk away saying, oh, I'm terribly guilty and I need to confess. But instead to say, then if that's what it takes, then I will recommit myself to follow. And I will prayerfully walk through the Gospel of Mark saying, how did Jesus live that I may follow after him and follow in his footsteps? Because that's clearly what Mark has in mind. You are freed by what Jesus Christ does from the power of sin and death to follow him. That's the gospel. Follow me. I will make you fishers of men. It's what Jesus has committed himself to do. And it is an absolute joyful thing when he does it. Now, verse 21. They went to Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching. Again, that word immediately shows up. It's our reason that we would never want to stop reading at verse 20, but to continue on because Mark still has more to say. He's creating a bigger picture. It's not just that one story. There's a whole scene going on. He's shown us in the first few verses that he clearly has authority over men and women just like us to call us to respond and to obey. And what he's going to show us next is that he has authority as well over unclean spirits. And so we read in verse 21, they came into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught as one who had authority, not as the scribes. It's our first point where Jesus and the Pharisees and scribes and the religious system of that day began to divide. It's going to get much more significant as the story goes on. The gulf between Jesus and the Pharisees will become incredibly wide as the story unfolds. But this is our first glimmer. What's going on in this verse? It goes something like this. When Jesus shows up, they recognize he has authority. Does that word sound like another one we use quite a bit? The word author? The word authority and the word author are absolutely connected. And the idea is that when you author something, you are writing something original. If you are its author, that means you're not just copying what others have said before you. We call that plagiarism. We're told in school, don't do it. Jesus showed up, and he teaches that way. Now, that is very different from how the scribes of that day were teaching, because they considered it a proper way to teach, to come and to quote what other teachers had taught. In fact, you showed how good of a teacher you were by how much of your talk was filled with quotations. As Rabbi so-and-so said, and the Rabbi so-and-so said, that was how it was done. For someone to come and just start talking and teaching was unheard of. And the people recognized it right away. He taught as one who had authority. Not like the scribes, not like the people they were used to. Immediately, verse 23, there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit. I think Mark wants you to understand that this was not an unusual scene. That this man with the unclean spirit, it's not like this is the first time he showed up at synagogue. Now, the synagogue was somewhat the equivalent of the church for the people of Israel at this point in history. Not quite the same, because the synagogue was where they met to do their religious meetings, but it was also where they would meet to teach their kids. It was their community center. It was the courthouse. It was the hub, the central building that was there existing in every community within Israel. But on the Sabbath, they would meet there to hear the scribes teach. And on the Sabbath, the whole community would come together. And it seems the way Mark tells the story that every Sabbath, this man with an unclean spirit shows up to essentially go to church. Does that strike you as odd? It should. Because the Jewish faith was all about getting clean. You go read the Old Testament through the laws. Sometimes it bogs us down. But if you've ever read, you know, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, through those things, you understand that the law is all designed around how do we help people stay clean, to not touch things that we would consider, you know, ceremonially unclean, to not eat the wrong food, not go to the wrong places. They lived their lives focused on making sure they followed this set of rules to stay clean. And now, at the central place where that religion functions, what do we find? An unclean man. This is Mark's way of telling us that this one religious system that had its whole goal focused on making sure people were clean couldn't do what it set out to do. Otherwise, there should never have been an unclean man. Now, this unclean man had an unclean spirit. Elsewhere in the Gospels, you know, different writers will use the word demon. It's used interchangeably, but Mark here uses the unclean spirit word, I think by design, to tell us that this is a problem for Judaism. It can't do what it claims it can do. The unclean man cries out with a loud voice, "What do you have to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Be silent and come out of him." The unclean spirit convulsed and cried out with a loud voice and came out of him. See, not only does Jesus have the authority to call men to follow, but Jesus now, Mark shows us, has the authority over unclean spirits. He is able to do what Judaism had been unable to do, to actually deal with the problem of cleanliness and uncleanliness. Now, a couple more verses here before we wrap up and just consider a closing thought. The people were amazed. See what Mark tells us next? They were all amazed. And they were questioning among themselves, saying, "What is this? A new teaching with authority." See, they understand what Mark's trying to help us see. It's an issue of what kind of authority is this? If we're going to trust someone to deal with the problem of sin, that someone better have absolute authority to do what he claims to do. Mark just keeps pointing out over and over and over again, you can trust him. He has authority to do what he tells us he is doing. The people were amazed. Now that word, unfortunately, it's one of those tricky ones when you come from one language to another and into English. It's a little bit of a peculiar one because that word actually is connected to a whole bunch of words in the Old Testament. The word mighty. Mighty deeds, actually. In fact, did you notice in Mark so far, Jesus has not done a miracle? I mean, he has. He's done some miraculous things and he will, but Mark won't actually label them as miracles. But over and over, he will call them mighty deeds, or he'll have the people recorded as responding in this way. They are amazed because they're seeing a mighty deed. That's the word you would use. If you saw a mighty deed, you would say, "I'm amazed." And in the Old Testament, there's only one who does mighty deeds. God doesn't do miracles in the Old Testament. God does mighty deeds. That's why Mark wants you to meet Jesus. Not the doer of miracles at this point. The doer of mighty deeds, because he is God. Mark wants us to see that. Mark wants us to have absolute confidence that Jesus is the Son of God, worthy of our absolute devotion and obedience. And that when he says, "Follow me," and then demonstrates how life is to look, we should be lining up saying, "I will follow and do exactly as he says and asks." But that's hard. And so, as we come to a conclusion this morning, I want to encourage you to apply what we are considering, not with three action steps or do this and do that, not this week, but rather with a prayer that God would help us to be shaped by the gospel. There was a story a number of years ago, a fairly well-noted scholar, an atheist scholar, Dr. E.V. Ryu, who was a Greek scholar and was he was commissioned by Penguin Publishers, probably seeing Penguin Books, to translate the great Greek work of Homer into English. Apparently, he did one of the greatest translation jobs in history, and they were so excited, they came to him with another job, and they said, "Dr. Ryu, we know you're not a believer, but would you translate the Gospels into English?" He agreed. His son, a man by the name, I believe his name was Mark, who was a follower of Jesus Christ. Here's what he said. He said, "It will be very interesting to see what my father makes of the Gospels. But it will be much more interesting to see what the Gospels make of my father." He did become a believer shortly after starting his translation work. But that's not really the point. The point is, what about me? You see, we can go through the Gospel of Mark, and I can point out all sorts of historically interesting things and say, "Look at this word, and here's what it's mean, and isn't this fascinating?" And we can be fascinated, we can have those moments of, "Aha, I understand it." We can point out all sorts of historical stories and anecdotes. That's not what the Gospel's for. The Gospel's not there to fascinate us or interest us. The Gospel is there to transform us. It is good news that brings great joy and changes our lives. So here's the prayer. God, would you change the world through us as a church? Isn't that a great prayer? That's what I'm going to ask you to pray along with me over these months. Yes, I want to be changed personally. I want to see us as a church transformed by the gospel. I want to see Vernon. I want to see the North Okanagan. But we have a big God. We have a God who's able to transform the world. He started at this point, and so I want to encourage you to be praying that as we work our way through this book.